Okay, so friends, today is the continuation of our first ever Advent series together as a church. So this will be the second message in that series. The first one was last week, and we focused on the hope that is found in Advent last week on the entire time. This week, we're going to really focus on the love of God that we get to see through Advent. So if you weren't with us last week, or if you haven't participated in an Advent service before, essentially Advent comes from a Latin word that means the coming or arrival. So when we say Advent, that's what we mean, coming or arrival. So in Advent, you're celebrating several things. You're first celebrating the traditional celebrating fact of Christ came for a first Advent, meaning Christ came already. It's understanding that Christ left his rightful place in heaven and he entered into human history. He really came down into the fray for the problem of our sin. So what we're doing in Advent is we're celebrating the fact that Christ has come down already. But then there's another side of it also. We are anticipating what we call the second Advent, which would mean the second coming of Christ, when Christ will come back and fix completely everything that has been broken. So in the first Advent, he secured a way to pay for the problem of our sin. In the second Advent, the second coming, he's going to completely fix all that is broken. So death will be no more, sin will be no more, all tears will be wiped away from the people of God. Everything will be fixed that sin has undone. So that's a day promise, but we haven't seen it yet. So we're thankful for the fact that God has sent Jesus already and waiting for him to come again. So because of that, Advent is more than just our tradition of celebrating Christmas. There's a deeper meaning to what's going on. It's more than just lighting some candles. It's more than getting some wreaths and having symbolism through those. It's not just another way for us to say Christmas. For us, Advent is a uniquely Christian celebration of Christmas. Right? It's not that we're cooler than other people. It's the fact that we have a hope pent up in Advent or Christmas that other people don't. And that's the gospel hope that God would send his son. So it means something just a little bit different to us. So we will reflect on the promises of God all over the word. There's these promises that God goes, I'm going to do this for you. And the yes to all those promises is going to come through Christ. So we're going to look at those promises. And then we're also going to eagerly await for all of them to be fulfilled for us. So in the least corny or cliche way I can possibly say, Advent is about keeping Christ in this time of year. Okay? Not in the militant, like, I'm going to say Merry Christmas instead of Happy Holidays. It's letting us have the focus of Jesus. So we can make sure that really our traditions that are a lot of fun just don't overshadow our Savior. Like, that's what we're trying to do this time of year. So we can keep our ugly sweater Christmas parties. Those are fun, right? We can keep our mistletoe. We can keep our Christmas tree. We can still go see the magic tree if you're here in Columbia. We can do the gift exchanges. We can do all of that stuff. But we just need to understand around this time of year that those things are our secondary joys. They're a lot of fun. Have a good time with them, but they're secondary this time of year. What's primary to us is God's plan through Jesus. What our hope is tied up in, what our ultimate joy is tied up in, what passion and love we have is all tied up in the fact that God has made a plan, and central to that plan is sending Jesus. So that's why we're celebrating Advent. It's to keep our minds focused on what God has done. So we began our Advent series last week looking at the hope that is found in Christ. We looked through Isaiah and saw that there's this hope of this king who God is going to send. It was a promised king who would be unlike any other king who has ever ruled ever before. Because this king, he won't fall short and he won't fail us. He won't be a politician. He won't make a million promises and not do really any of the things that he promised. He won't be like that either. Instead, he will lead us perfectly. Under him, justice and righteousness will reign. He will see all things and make right decisions based upon the knowledge that he has, even the knowledge of our hearts, not some limited knowledge of just what he sees, which means some really amazing things will unfold. The marginalized really won't be taken advantage of anymore. The weak and the meek won't be bowled over anymore. This king will make sure that perfection comes and he rules rightly. So the news of this king was in Isaiah 11, the understanding that a promised king would come for Israel. When you hear Israel in the Old Testament, they're talking about the people of God. So there's this promised king for the people of God. And when Israel, the people of God, got this news that this king was going to come, they found themselves in kind of a difficult circumstance. They found themselves crushed, absolutely crushed and in despair and with really little hope at the time. So I think we've all had this at some point. Have you ever had that feeling in the pit of your stomach? Like that uncomfortable feeling, that moment when your stomach turns, when all of a sudden you face reality and you go, I've gotten myself into something that I can't get out of. Like I've gotten myself in so deep that there's no way that I'm either not going to get find out or I'm not going to get found out, or there's no way that I'm going to get out. And then your stomach just turns. You know, I can't escape this no matter how hard I try, and kind of despair rushes over you like a flood. This is where Israel finds themselves at that point in Isaiah 11. They're a conquered and overtaken people. So all these countries around Israel desperately wanted to be like them. They wanted to have all of the things that they had. And now instead of having all the things that these other countries had, these other countries overtook them and put them really into bondage, where all of their lands were stolen, all of their livestock was taken away from them, their temple was overrun. Essentially everything that gave them their identity was pulled away from them. They were a shadow of the people that they once were, and they were a shadow of the people that they were supposed to be, right? So they couldn't get out of this no matter how hard they tried. They were in a deep and pretty dark situation, we find out in Isaiah. What's important to understand for us, or to realize, or to wrap our heads around, is really the understanding of how did they get there? How did they get crushed? We can say, okay, they were crushed, their land was stolen, it wasn't so good for them. Okay, that's great, but how did they get to this place of despair? And if we're looking at that, we have to start back a ways. They got there, and it started quite a while before. Sin entered into the world, and God had a choice. I could destroy creation, or I could go another route. I could show them love, and I could show them mercy, and I could extend favor towards them. He decided, luckily, not to destroy and show mercy and favor. So he showed mercy and favor towards his people in Israel. He said, I'm going to love you. I'm going to care for you. They didn't win a talent contest. God didn't look at them and go, man, I just have to have you. You're so cool. Like, I can't quit you. None of that happened. He just goes, I love you, not because you're lovable. I love you because I've chosen to love you. So he looks at them, gives them the essence of grace, going, hey, you're not really that awesome. I'm just going to love you because I choose to, and I'm going to be your God, and you're going to be my people. I'm going to care for you when I could have just left you, or I could have destroyed you. So we covered this last week. He offers them relationship. Now, we're going to keep our mindset of grace about this. He doesn't say, hey, do all these things and now I will love you. He goes, now I have loved you. Now, the parameters of our relationship, of me being your God and you being my people, are going to look a little bit like this. I'm going to ask two things of you. The first thing is this. I'm going to ask you to really be faithful. I want you to be faithful to me like a marriage arrangement. I don't want you to step out on me. I want to be your God and your only God, and I want you to be my people. You're going to be my only people. So I want you to be faithful. I want you to be like a bride. I want you to be true. I want to be your true love. So the first thing that he asks, just don't cheat. Don't run in adultery. Be faithful to me. That's not too crazy of a request. And the second is this. I want you to be a missional people, which means I want you to be a blessing to other people. To other nations, I am blessing you so that you will bless them. When other lands look at you and look at Israel, I want them to see myself. I want them to see Yahweh. I want them to see the blessing and favor that I have given. I want in your actions for them to go, well, something's different about you, and they're going to have to figure out it is the God who loves them that has caused this kind of life to come out of them. So I want you to be faithful to me, and I want you to be a blessing to the nations. Those are the two requests. Just do those two things, and I'm going to be your God, and you're going to be my people. I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound crazy out of line, right? That doesn't sound too insane. It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty fair. You scrawny, ugly, duckling nation of Israel, I'm going to be your God, and you're going to be my people. You just have to follow this. Just don't cheat on me and be on mission. I think it's a good deal. Israel gets the God of the universe. So wrap your minds around the God who cast the stars into the sky, that's the God they get. The God who controls the oceans by the words of his mouth, that's the God they get. The God that breathes life into our lungs, that's the God they get. The God who holds all things together because he wants to, that's the God they get. I think I got a pretty good deal there, right? That's a pretty good backer to have behind you, except they couldn't do their part. They couldn't be faithful, and they wouldn't be a blessing to the nations. They kept running headlong into their sin and into their adultery over and over and over. So something kind of had to change. Now, if we're going to break apart this Old Testament story of Israel, the love story between God and Israel, into a shorter, maybe more familiar storyline, I think it would look something like this. Now, this isn't going to be perfect. It's not going to be complete. It's not gospel. This is more just a storyline that we put to their relationship and the history of their relationship. It would look something like this, right? boy meets girl, and she thinks he's cute, right? He's strong, and he's hot and sexy and whatnot, all those words that you want to throw out there. He's really comes from a good family. He's got a good head on his shoulders. He's a hard worker. He's respectful. He's polite. He says all the right things at just the right times. He'd even carry her books for her. He'll open the door even when they're just going to the grocery store. Like, he's that guy that makes us annoyed, right? He's that guy. That's the relationship that's happening. And as this unfolds, they're spending more and more and more time together, and they're talking for hours upon hours upon hours. And he listens to her intently. He actually cares what she has to say. He treats her like a queen. He brings her flowers to work. Get this. He doesn't just pay for flowers to be delivered. He brings them so people see them, right? Apparently that's important to girls, but he does that. He writes her love notes just to say, hey, I'm thinking of you and I care for you and you're beautiful. He watches chick flicks and even cries at the corny parts and pretends that they're sad. He would easily pass up guy time to go shopping, which is weird. It's becoming obvious that he's deeply in love with her. And as this continues, she falls in love with him, and she begins to just think thoughts and dream of happily ever after when they're going to be married. And when they're going to be married, everything's going to be perfect because everything she's ever dreamed of, she's going to get, and everything's going to be wonderful because they're never, ever, ever going to be apart. Everything looks good, and she's just dreaming this is going to be perfect. But then they get married, and things change a little bit at that point. At first, things were great. The dream seems to be coming together perfectly. Everything's lining up. This is great, but slowly she begins to notice some things about him. It's not really clear if he's changed or she just noticed things that she ignored before, but all of a sudden she maybe thinks that maybe he doesn't open the car door maybe as much as I thought he did before, and maybe he doesn't really bring me flowers as much as I would like him to. And then she starts wondering, you know what? I wonder if he's ever listened to me or if he just nods and says, uh-huh, a lot. Like, I don't think he listens. And she begins to look at other people and think, man, I wonder if he is as good to me as that husband is to her. And then she finds out he really hates the notebook and he would rather hang out with other guys. And in her mind, like, things are changing. You can cue the B.B. King song, like, the thrill is gone. I contemplated whether I was going to sing that to you, but the thrill would be gone from that. So, man, I wanted to so bad, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't. You're welcome. Man, the battle's in my mind. Then she starts to look around her neighborhood, and she starts to notice some things. And they're not really new things. She just picks up on some things that maybe hadn't mattered to her before. The other ladies in the neighborhood drives a nicer car than she does, and that frustrates her. And some of the other homes that have been there the entire time, all of a sudden she notices that some of those homes are larger than hers. And she imagines that other wives probably get flowers more, and other husbands are probably more dependable than hers. And really dissatisfaction begins to well up in her heart. To make things really worse, she figures out that he has expectations of her as well. And his expectations that once seemed manageable and agreeable, all of a sudden they seem unfair, over the top, and completely unreasonable. And she begins to think, maybe my dreams really aren't going to come true. She begins to really question whether happiness will come. She questions his values and his character and his wisdom because he's not doing all the things that she dreamed that he would do. And she begins to wonder, I wonder if we really have a future together. See, you know this story because it's a story that we see in soap operas all the time. Displeasure grows in someone. Then she gives displeasure, really the seed of displeasure, water to grow by just stewing on it. And then she gives these thoughts of displeasure legs to have flesh because she starts actually talking about him and telling the guy that he is annoying. And as that has grown too, and you see this pattern of thinking about something and then talking about something, then actions are sure to come. And she ends up starting to look to other places for satisfaction. Her dissatisfaction has grown too much, and she thinks, somewhere else I can have my desire met. Somewhere else I can have my satisfaction taken care of. What started off as a romance is about to end in a train wreck. It sounds like a divorce is in the making, a sad progression that really could happen to any people if they're not careful. It's all too familiar scenario. This is the scenario that Isaiah paints of the God of the universe and the people of Israel. He goes, this is what happens to them in the Old Testament. This is what happened to the Old Testament people of God and God. When all of a sudden God called Israel out of Egypt to be his, for them to be his people and him to be their God, they started dreaming big dreams, right? Dreams of everything going well with God being behind them. They had visions of power and glory and wealth and comfort and security. Their life was going to be awesome. They were going to be a big deal. They were going to be happy. God was going to supply all of their desires, so they thought. They were going to have a massive sugar daddy and protector, and things were going to be great. What could possibly go wrong with this plan? What went wrong is they soon found out that their life wasn't like the dream that they had created. The dream and all the things that they wanted, this wasn't the reality of what really happened. Things weren't perfect in every way that they hoped they would be. They didn't have all the wealth and the power and the prosperity that they wanted in the way that they wanted it. And like the story before, they similarly started finding out that maybe God has expectations of them as well, and they start feeling like maybe those are unreasonable and maybe those are burdens. So they begin to question God's, really, his awesomeness and his goodness towards them. His ability to care for them. They even begin to question his character and his motives and his wisdom. Does this sound familiar? Like seeing the things that God asks and going, man, I don't know, that may be too much. Have you done that? You ever open the Word of God and start to question the wisdom of God? You open the book and you start seeing what he asks as far as sexual purity and go, man, that's a whole lot more than I think you should be able to ask of me. And then you look and you see, well, these are my expectations as far as tithing and living a generous life. And you're like, man, that's a lot for you to ask. And then you see his expectations to forgive ones who have done you wrong. And you're like, I don't know, man. I don't know. That's a whole lot for you to expect from me. That's too much. That's over the top. You know, I don't know if God has a clue of all the things that I've gone through and what my life is look like, or else he would never ask me to do those things if he really wants me to be happy. And you begin to just question his goodness, right? Does he know how much I make and how much school debt I have? Does he know what my MasterCard bill is and he wants me to be generous? He does not know me. There's no way I can do that. Does he not know what that person did and how they hurt me and how they're not even sorry, and he wants me to forgive them and just brush it under the rug like it's never happened? I can't do that, and I can't believe that he would ask that. These are the mindsets that well up. Have you ever done that? I have. If you're honest, you'd say, yeah, often this morning. Like we do that. We look at the requests and we go, man, that's a lot that you're asking of me. And this is what happened to Israel. This was their struggle. They're going, man, that's a lot for you to ask of us. Eventually, the struggle caused Israel to look elsewhere for satisfaction. So as a nation, she started seeking protection of other kings. And then she started to look for the power of other militaries to bring her comfort. And then she started seeking prosperity and blessing through worshiping pagan gods. She did exactly what the disillusioned bride did, because she thought that God wasn't willing or able to make her happy. So Israel started to look elsewhere for her happiness. Two former lovers are now separated, and a relationship is strained really bad, to the point that you're like, I don't know if this is going to be fixed. So Israel followed pagan kings and pagan gods and pagan idols really with everything she had. Like she didn't halfway do that. She all the way followed it, all the way into hopeless captivity. The gods that promised so much happiness and joy and pleasure and security and all of this that they had followed all of a sudden enslaved Israel. Do you get this? Israel left the God of the universe, who had freed her from Egypt and given her lands, given her milk and honey, all the other stuff, left that God who'd given you tangible things to go worship whittled wood. And all of a sudden she found herself enslaved because of it. How far did she run? How far did Israel run? How far did she fall away? Well, they began to find a carving that Ed down the road had made last year, and then all of a sudden they put it in their home and said, that's my God now, because it promises me prosperity. And then they'd find a rock that looked like something, whatever, and they're like, oh, that's my God now. And Joe down the road, he forged something out of gold. So then they worshiped that as well, and it went so far that the people of God, remember, who were charged to just be faithful, don't cheat, some of them even began to sacrifice their own children, because they believed if they did that to these gods that they would find happiness and pleasure and all of the things that they longed for. They went way down the road. They went as far as you possibly could down the road of idolatry. This is something that we need to understand. The idols that we serve to try and buy peace and happiness are utterly insane. Whittled wood, God of the universe. Oh, I'll take this. Okay. I don't know if that's a solid idea. There's a point in Isaiah where God, there's a whole chapter in Isaiah where essentially God looks down at Isaiah and goes, really? Like Egypt, no Egypt, land, I've led you through wars, I've given you all of this stuff, I'm your God, you're my people, temple, all of this stuff, I've given you all of this and you're going to seek happiness, not in me now, you're gonna seek it in sex. That's the trade you're going to make, okay? Really, you're going to seek it in how much gold you can get. You're going to seek it in this, and we're thinking, man, those guys are dumb. We do the same thing, right? Our idols just look different. Ours aren't out of wood. They're made out of plastic and metal now. They're our TVs, our computers, our cars, our iPhones. Our idols are our jobs. Our idols are our bank accounts. Our idols are our vacations. Our idols are our spouse, our relationship, our feeling, our knowledge, our degrees that we can pile up. They're just as dumb as theirs are, and they enslave us just the way that theirs did. So Isaiah captures this pattern of the people of God. They got farther and farther and farther away. As their idolatry got more and more out of control, so much so that you could say, I wonder if they even remembered that they were married in the first place. I wondered if they even remembered they had a relationship with God. See, the relationship seemed broken without a chance of repair. It's a love story gone bad. So then we got to go, okay, well, what happens now? What happens? Does God give up? Does he walk away? Does he say, forget you? And this is the beauty of it. He doesn't. See, he ends up fighting for the hearts of the people that he loves instead of giving up. He loves them enough to fight for them just the same way that he loves you and refuses to quit for you. See, he refuses to accept their rejection of his love. So Isaiah says that God looks at his people and goes, okay, you foolish, arrogant, sinful, wayward people. I love you, and I'm not going to quit, and I'm going to fix this no matter how far you run. You are all of these things, and none of the things that I've asked you to be. And I love you enough that I'm not going to quit, I'm not going to give up, and I'm going to fix it because you obviously can't. And in Isaiah 42, we see this fleshed out. What's God's plan to fix it? Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 3, says this. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I've put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. Listen to this. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. So how's God going to fix the busted up relationship with his people? How's he going to salvage the seemingly unsalvageable relationship with his people? Isaiah 42 says, well, he's going to fix it by sending his servant, his chosen one. This one that he's going to send is one that the Spirit of God is on, and this one is going to come, and he's going to fix all things that have been broken. This is the one whom God will send, who is not like any other. He's not loud, he's not boisterous, he's not violent, he's not self-interested. He's come for the people that he loves. And says, instead, he will come for the bruised reed, which he won't break. What that's talking about is that's a metaphor for the people of Israel. The bruised, they're busted up. They're almost dead. The relationship's almost gone. And he goes, I'm coming for that bruised reed. Right? They're kind of like a candle where the flame is just barely going. And he goes, this man will come and he will fix the flame of their relationship. He will stoke it. He will make everything okay again. He won't quench it and he'll bring forth justice. He'll repair everything that has been broken. Do you see the beauty of this statement? The beauty of the love of God found in this? See, the relationship between God and Israel was on life support. It almost didn't exist. If you're following boxing and you're using a boxing analogy, Israel is on the ground. The count's at 9. It's done. Like people are getting ready to head to the doors. It's over with. This is the point. And God still says, I'm going to fix it. It doesn't look good, but I'm going to fix it. Years and years and years of a broken relationship have happened. So God has sent priest after priest after priest early in the Old Testament. That didn't fix the problem of the relationship with God and his people. Then he sent king after king after king. Didn't fix it. Then he sent prophet after prophet after prophet. It still didn't fix it. See, he could have sent more law, but he already sent the law. That's not going to win the heart of the people back. He could have freed them from what enslaved them, but he did that in Egypt, and that didn't work at all. He could have given them more blessing and more land, and he had done that, and that just caused them to run even farther away from him. See, none of the things that had been done before could fix the issue of the broken relationship between God and his people. None of them had won the heart of God's people back to himself. So God knows this. Something different has to happen. The same thing's not going to work. Something different has to happen at this point. So he knows that when a relationship is this broken and this busted up, doing the same thing repeatedly, especially if that's the same thing that broke it in the first place, isn't going to fix it. See, that's what we call a rut in a relationship, or maybe the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and over and crossing your fingers and hoping for a different result. God goes, I know that that's not going to work. Something has to change or nothing is ever going to change. We've thrown leader upon leader and blessing upon blessing and that hasn't fixed it. Something else has to happen. So we'll ask ourselves another question. What has to change? Because we need to get this. It wasn't just circumstance that unfolded, that happened, that broke up their relationship. It wasn't that. It was something else. Something kept popping up that busted up the relationship of God and his people. Something kept fracturing it. It's the same thing that fractures our relationship with God. It's sin. See, sin had to be fixed. And no prophet and no king that had been sent before and no law could fix the problem of sin. See, sin is this, it's our heartfelt desire to be God. Inside every one of us, we want to push God away and go, I want to be that. I want to do that. I want to control things. Sin is our predisposition to demand to get our way, to look out and assume that we deserve everything that we want and things should go our way. These are the things that cause us to turn from God and break our relationship with him. It was sin that led Israel to worshiping idols. Because they figured, hey, I can control this, right? This is what we do. I can control my sin. I can control how I worship these idols, and then I can control the idols, and then I'll get what I want from them. And they said, well, okay. And then it was sin that caused Israel to seek pagan kings, thinking, well, we can control these kings and get what we want from them with no ill effects, which obviously didn't work because now they had all of their stuff stolen and they're overrun. It's sin that causes us to really take blessings for granted, right? Remember when you're praying for that big thing, like, God, I need you, please help me. And then it happens. You're like, it should have happened anyway. That's sin in your heart. It assumes that you should get everything that you want and everything that should have gone, everything should go your way. It's sin that causes us to endure astonishing amounts of pain because it blinds us to the destructiveness of our selfishness. So it's sin that had corrupted the hearts of God's people. It's sin that corrupts our hearts, and nothing had been done to fix the problem of sin that would ultimately win the heart of God's people back. There had been things to try and work things out, but nothing had dealt with the sin. So it's in Isaiah that God says this, I'm going to do something different, right? We've tried all this other stuff multiple times. It hasn't worked. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to send my servant. I'm going to send my son. I'm going to send Jesus, and he's going to win the war for your hearts. This one's actually going to work. I'm not going to send you more other mortal kings. I'm not going to give you more laws. I'm not going to give you more blessings, and I'm not going to give you more curses. I'm going to do something radically different at this point. Right? I'm going to do something that no other king has done, no other king could do. I'm going to send this one and he's going to trade places with you. Nothing else has worked. Nothing else has worked. I'm going to send this one and he's going to take your place. He's going to suffer the punishment that you deserve for your sin, and he's going to be perfect. He's going to be the perfect bride that you could never actually be. He's going to do that. I hope your ears are open to that. We hear good news so much that we miss out on how big it is, right? We get over inoculated or indoctrinated or whatever you want to say. Do you hear this? He goes, I'm going to take your place. You sinful, horrible people, I will take your place and I'll give you my righteousness. This is pretty big news here. Jesus will be everything that we can't be and take everything that we deserve to take. John Stott says this, the essence of sin is that we want to substitute ourselves for God. That's the essence of all sin. And he also says the essence of salvation is that God substitutes himself for us. Right? We put ourselves where God deserves to be and goes, hey, this is my rightful place. I should get what I want. I deserve all of these things. While he puts himself where we deserve to be. This is why we call the gospel good news and actually mean it. Because one who is way more righteous than us goes, I'll trade spots with you. You're like, that is really good news. I couldn't fix this. See, this is why we looked at last week, the idea of the hope found in Advent. We have hope because we're loved. We're loved so much that God would substitute himself for us. Get this, his righteousness and holiness for our adultery and sin. Like, that's a bad trade, he knows. But he loves us and gives it anyway. No, let's look at something. We have in the New Testament what's called the Synoptic Gospels. In the beginning of the New Testament, they're Matthew, Mark, and Luke, first three books of the New Testament. They're essentially all books that focus on the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. They focus on his ministry. They focus on all the things that he has done. But they focus on it from different perspectives. So in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, often you'll find the exact same story, but with different wording, because it's from a slightly different perspective, okay? So this is how they work. Now, interestingly, Matthew and Luke both give the Christmas narrative, meaning they do the whole manger thing and all that. Like, they give the story of the birth of Jesus, but Mark doesn't do that, right? Those are at the beginning of Matthew and Luke, but Mark skips the manger, and he goes right to the baptism of Jesus. We see this in Mark 1, 9 through 11. It'll be on the screen. Says this, this is the beginning of Mark. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And when he came out of the water, immediately he saw the heavens being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven. This is God's voice. And it said, "You are my beloved Son. With you I am well pleased." So why would this be? Why would Mark skip the manger stuff? Right? Why would he skip that he was born lowly and all that? Why would he skip it just to go straight to baptism and these words from God? Now, we have to do a little bit of guessing, I guess, but I think it's because Mark wants to skip to the good news. Like, he wants to get to the good part. He wants to get to the part that you and I really, really, really need to hear. He wants to skip to the gospel. See, I think Mark is super grateful and glad that Jesus came and was born, but he's more glad on what it means that Jesus came and he was born, right? He's glad he came, but the symbolism, what it buys for us, what it does that he came, that's the part that he's really psyched about. In verse 11, it says, "When the skies opened and the voice of God rang out, when the heavens were torn open, God said, 'You are my beloved Son, and in you I am well pleased.'" This is God saying, he's here. I promised it. You didn't think I was going to do it. He's here right now. The one I promised, the one who's going to take care of it, my servant, my son, he's here. The one in whom my soul delights. He is Jesus. He's the one who's going to do something amazing. He's going to substitute himself for you to fix the problem that you could never fix. You see, this is the day that love came down, right? That's why we have hope, because we are loved. When God, the loving Father, the eternal Father, sent the one that he loved, his Son. Get this, that's sacrifice. He sent the one that he loved to rescue us. Why? Because he loves us as well. Because he loves us deeply. Isaiah 42, 4 through 9 talks more about when Jesus comes. It says, "He will not grow faint or be discouraged." This is really good news. "Until he's established justice on the earth. And the coastlands wait for his law. Thus says God, the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and the spirit to those who walk in it. I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for my people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. I am the Lord. That is my name. My glory I give to no other, nor my praise to carved idols." That's kind of a slam on them worshiping stupid dolls out of wood. "Behold, the former things have come to pass, and new things I now declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them." Isaiah 42, he's finishing out fleshing the plan for Jesus. He will come to rescue the bruised reed, the busted up, hopeless people who it doesn't look like anything's ever going to be fixed for them. The flame that's almost burnt out. It's Jesus who's going to come for that. And he's going to have an epically difficult task. And it says he will not be discouraged in that. What does that mean? It means he won't give up and he won't give in. Right? The garden before Jesus' death, when he's knowing that the cup of wrath is going to be emptied on him, he didn't quit. He's looking death in the face. Remember, he not only has to die, the full cup of the wrath of God has to be emptied upon him for every sin we've ever committed. And he goes, I'll walk that path. It's not my first choice because it's not going to be awesome, but I will walk my path. I will do that. See, instead of quitting, God sends this one. It says he'll be everything for my people. He will lead them, but he'll lead them by loving them, and he'll love them by substituting himself for them. He will take them by the hand. even the unfaithless people of Israel, who'd take them by the hand and walk them in his love into his covenant promise, going, I know you've done all these things, but I'm going to fix it. I'm going to love you. I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to absorb what you have done, so that once again, you can be my people and I can be your God. You can be faithful and you can be the light of the nations again that I have called you to be. This is my plan. I'll do something different. Tim Keller says this: love always involves personal sacrifice. Always. Says in the real world, if you're going to love real people with real problems and real difficulties, you're going to have to understand that you're going to have to share their problems if you're going to claim to love them. See, at some point, you're going to have to kind of trade places with them in a way. You're going to bear the weight of their struggle. This is what true love to someone looks like. See, in our culture, we have all these weird relationships where we go, I love you, and then somebody goes through something and you go, I don't love you anymore. This isn't the biblical definition of love. The biblical definition is, I love you, you're going through that, I'm going to hold it for you. I'm going to help you. That I shouldn't have to. I didn't do that. I didn't cause that. But I love you enough that I will sacrifice what is rightfully should be my path in order to carry something for you, in order to help you. I'm going to sacrifice. I'm going to help bear the burden. See, if you're a parent, you know this is true. You sacrifice for your children in a million ways, right? Ah, man, looks like you dropped a bomb. Sucks to be you. Right, you sacrifice, you deal with it. Like you give your time, you give your money, you get chucked on a whole lot at the beginning. You give a whole lot of sacrifices in order to help the kid. Then in your marriage, if you were married, if your marriage isn't horrible, you know that this is true as well. You sacrifice, you care for, you absorb wrong, you lead, you love, you absorb things at times because you sacrifice for the ones that you love. If you have a true friend, you know this is also true. You don't walk with them just until they annoy you or until they've done something dumb, or else you wouldn't have any friends. You walk them into the spot where they've done something difficult and go, I love you enough that I'm not going to leave you. I'll even help you. See, there's no love without sacrifice. There's no love without laying down your rights. If you say that you love someone but you will not sacrifice for them, you don't love them, you just know them. You know who they are. See, in order to help someone, you're willing to give things up because you love them deeply. Love is always willing to carry the burdens of the beloved. And if it's not, it is not love. At least it's not the biblical definition of love. Right? You don't do this to enable someone, but you do this to exchange yourself for someone and carry them and say, you're not alone. I'm here for you. I love you. To exchange your position, to carry their burdens for their good. This is the biblical definition. You look, you'll see this throughout the word all over, 2 Corinthians 8:9. For you know that the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you by his poverty might become rich. Well, okay, so you see what this is saying? God, owner of everything, comes down to be born in a manger, to be lowly, to be poor, right? That's a sacrifice. I have everything. I'll give up everything to help you. That's a sacrifice so that we could have the righteousness of Christ. That's a sacrificial love modeled by the Father. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. What does this mean? Husbands, in order to love your wife, you sacrifice. You lay down what you want sometimes. You lay down your first choice. You do the hard work of leading and loving and guiding and shepherding and caring for. Why? Because Christ did. If it's real love, you sacrificed. Paul also gave this example to us that's described in 2 Corinthians 5:21. It'll show that it's always accompanied by sacrifice if you love someone. It says this: for our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. You see the sacrificial love found here? Now, that's a confusing wording, but what it's saying is this: for our sake, that's us, right? We're all sinners, right? We're all sinners. For our sake, for sinners' sake, God made his son, who's not sin, right? Sinners, God, Jesus, not sinful. God made his son, who was not sin, to be sin for us. What does that mean? Well, Jesus, the one who didn't sin, decided to carry the weight of our sin so that we could have the righteousness of Christ. That's sacrifice. He goes, I will shoulder it. I will fix it. I will deal with it for you. This is what love looks like. See, God made our problem his own. You get that? I don't know what you think about God today, but if you understand the biblical God, he made your problem his own. He didn't say, it's your deal, figure it out or I'll crush you. He said, I'll make your problem my own. He substituted himself for us so that we may find life, so that we may be forgiven, so that sin may be defeated in us and our hearts won back to God. He goes, I'll take care of this. I'll do this because I love you. I'll do this because I care for you. That's why I hope that our hearts in Advent are overwhelmed by a feeling of love, that we're celebrating that God made a plan, and through that plan, he righteously goes, I will love you enough to substitute myself for you. I'll fix it. I'll make it right. You can't do it. I'll take care of it. Friends, my hope for us today is really simple. It's this. First, that we would remain hopeful. From last week, I pray that we'd have hope. Things are busted up. We have leadership that doesn't lead well. We have a world that's broken. We have disease, death, sin. We have all these things that are difficult. I hope that we understand that we have hope in the fact that God goes, I didn't forget, I will fix it. I will fix it all. But secondly, I hope that we feel overwhelmed by the love of God. Not this fake sense of superficial, God loves you, but a real sense of love so deep that God would pour out his son for you. Right? You have to wrap your mind around that. There's not some like, oh, forget about it, it's no big deal. He sent his son to die for you. That's the only way that your sin gets taken care of. See, this is what happened. He decides, I'll take your place. The sinless one takes our place. He stands as a sinner so we could stand as a saint before God, hands clean, loved, accepted, adopted into the family of God. How great is this love, a love like no other. And I hope that you feel that. And I hope that you do. I don't know how you see God. I don't know if you see him as this religious thing, but I also hope that you don't see him as distant and unloving and demanding towards you. Because if it's true, right, we have to go by the assumption. Do you believe this is true, or do you believe it's just a bunch of narratives that we talk about every week? If you believe that this is true, then God is not distant and demanding. He's very close and very loving. Because he goes, you can't fix it no matter how hard you try. I'm just going to work on you hard enough until you'll submit to me, until you'll love me, until you'll know me, and I will adopt you as my son or as my daughter. He stands close, willing to trade his place. What greater love could you ever find? There's not a million things you do to come into the family of God. I don't know how some of you stand today, but I want you to know I would love for you to have this hope and feel this love that some of us who are believers are. So if you don't know where you stand with God and you're going, I don't know how to get in and I'm kind of thinking about it. If you are thinking about it, like that's good news because that means God's stalking you. Like he's going, I'm going to win your heart. I love you. You don't think I'm going to catch you, but I almost got you. Like he's doing that. That's good news for you. But if you're wondering how do I get in, you just go, I need you to take my place. Like tag in. I can't do it. I need you. I've tried this. I've tried that. I've tried morality. I've tried this church. I've tried that system. I've tried all this stuff, and I can't fix all the issues. I need. I'm going to try the other one. Will you take my place? I need you. I have a sin issue that I can't deal with. Would you take my place? What would you give me your righteousness? Would you love me? Would you adopt me? If you do that, the beauty of that is he will. He doesn't go, I'll think about it and let you know next week. He goes, yeah. Yeah, I've done all of this for you. I've been waiting on you. I've been watching you. I've been pulling at your heart all of this time. My hope is that you would do that. And if you would, that you would come tell someone, that you would come tell me or somebody else that we could pray for you. But what better time than an Advent to not lose the meaning of Christmas, but understand that you are loved fully. May we find peace and comfort and love in this. Man, you guys can come back up. If nothing else, just downshift in December, right? We can make a card that says that. Remember that you're going through the gauntlet. You have party after party after get-together after family dinner after ugly sweater party, and you got to get gifts, and you got to get on Amazon, and you got to go to the mall, and everybody hates going to the mall. Like you have all of that stuff going, and it's going to try and pull your attention and pull your affection, and what that's going to do is it's going to make you forget that you are loved more than you ever possibly could know. So my hope is for you and for me that we don't forget how much the Father has loved for us, enough that he doesn't demand a bunch. He goes, I'll fix it. I'll take your place. I'll stand there. You get this, and I will absorb your sin because I love you. That's what we're celebrating. God made a plan, sent his son to do that. I hope that you understand that. Will you stand and will you pray with me today? God, I thank you that you're better than we deserve. Your good news is deeper than we understand. Your gospel covers every angle of our sinfulness, God. God, I pray that our hearts would be overwhelmed, that our cups would be full, that our hearts would be joyous, that we have been loved deeply through you. That no matter how far we have gone, no matter how far we've gone, no matter how far we have run, we are not too far gone for your hand to grab us. There is none who has sinned too deeply that cannot be adopted into your family. We thank you for that. We thank you that you've made a plan. We thank you that you have sent your son. We thank you that you didn't leave us hanging. And we thank you that you are loving. God, I pray that you would pour your love out on your people, that we'd be overwhelmed by it, and that we would worship in light of it today. God, be glorified in us. Be glorified in everything we do. Amen.